If we're talking about migration and climate change, the number you usually hear is like in 2050 there will be 200 million climate refugees. That sounds a bit exaggerated, actually. Is this number not being used as a wake-up call?
Well, that's an interesting point. In the report that we've written called In Search of Shelter, we explicitly did not mention numbers because the numbers that are available are based on experts' estimation. And so the number that you mentioned, 200 million, is the most frequently cited number that came out by the International Organization for Migration, IOM, in 2008. And just to give you an idea of how broad the estimates are, the low figure is provided by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. The estimate is 25 million environmentally induced migrants today.
Yeah.
My own, the institute director where I work, estimated that we would have 50 million in 2011. The IOM puts the figure at 200 million, something like by 2050. And then the number goes all the way up to 700 million, and that's a report issued by Christian Aid in 2007. So there's really a broad range. And for that reason, our report is based on what we've observed in the field, so it's empirical, and also the quantitative things we know about climate change and where people live. But we didn't go that far. One thing, though, that is interesting.
Okay, but of course, the climate variation has influenced people to migrate since the beginning. So why is the situation different now?
Absolutely. People have always migrated, and a lot of times people have migrated because of changes in their environment. They've gone to warmer places or cooler places. I think what's the game changer with climate change is the pace of climate change. I think some of our major ecological systems have the potential to tip, like glacier melt or drying trends in Africa or sea level rise. So that's the one thing, the absolute just momentum of climate change. And on the other, there's never been so many people living on Earth before. And so you get climate change affecting, you know, really the entire planet in different ways. And now people live in all of the already desirable spots. And so in a lot of places, like the Nile Delta, which is a highly populated area, faces desertification and sea level rise. Populations are literally being squeezed into areas where people are already living. And so that just raises some questions about what will we do.
Yeah, and it's of course because there's a densely populated areas that are in danger. For example, the Bangladesh is example. What can the government of Bangladesh do to adapt to these climate changes?
Well, we are asking those questions ourselves. We brought out a report at the Bonn Climate Talks, which just ended yesterday, and we were talking with some officials from the Bangladesh government, delegates who had come to negotiate on the climate change. And they were also wondering the same thing. One delegate told us Bangladeshis love their country, they want to stay home, and they'll have to find solutions within their borders. And then a day later, an Indian reporter asked a similar question. Well, is it feasible for Bangladeshis to come over to India? And it was a little bit of a rhetorical question because there are some tensions at borders, like between India and Bangladesh and whatnot, and it's really a question. One thing that we noticed in our 24 case studies or our empirical field work worldwide was that most migration related to environmental change, including climate change, will probably happen within a country's borders or regionally. Like in Africa, you may see some cross-border movement, but the people who are most affected by climate change are those who are really probably some of the most poor and most vulnerable people.
And, of course, they are the ones that didn't really contribute to the climate change.
That's absolutely the question that's coming up now. What do we do? It wasn't their fault. How do we help them?
Mm-hmm. And are the polluting countries taking the responsibility, or is there a little bit too little response?
That's also going to be the big question. I'll tell you what we did see, which was surprising and positive. As you know, the draft negotiating text has just come out, and this draft negotiating text will be refined and formed, and that will become the climate agreement coming out of the Copenhagen climate talks in December of this year. And what surprised us all was we, as a wider community, including IOM and UNHCR and humanitarian organizations, were hoping to get one or two words in the treaty or in the negotiating text on human mobility, migration, displacement, because we know this is an issue and we have to get some kind of hook or foothold. Now, what was surprising to us is that not only did we get a key word, but we got a full sentence. And for people on the street, they think it's completely ridiculous to be so concerned about one sentence in a negotiating text. But the significance of that is that after Copenhagen, there will be a small kind of mandate to explore the really pressing questions, what do we do about it? Now, the delegates, we thought actually it might be that the delegates would take the sentence out and say, you know, it's not in our mandate to deal with all of these issues. Climate change can't be isolated as the main thing that makes people migrate. And that's true. People migrate for a variety of reasons, and they're mixed, you know, in economic and environmental factors are mixed together. If a person is a farmer and they're losing their livelihoods in part because of climate change, for them it's about keeping their jobs. But you can see that climate change is making millions of people have a much harder time staying employed. But anyway, what happened is...
Can I ask another question with respect to the Bonn conference? Yeah?
Yeah, that's right.
Because, it's not been in the news a lot. It's the run-up to the Copenhagen conference. Mm-hmm. But we just got a mail by... It's an environmental organization. And they were quite negative. And one of the things that is relevant with respect to this issue is that they say that there's no money on the table from the industrial countries to attack the adaptation in poor countries. So they're not as optimistic as you. But is it correct that there's the industrialized countries don't engage themselves to do anything about it to help the South?
I think that the comment by the NGO colleague is correct. One of the biggest debates on the adaptation side is who pays and how much do they pay. And there's a big agenda of how you actually address the problems of climate change, but that agenda, including migration, is not moving very quickly because the big debate is, well, how much is it going to cost? What if we have to relocate people?
Mm-hmm. Because there's also a discussion about calling them climate refugees or climate migrants.
Yeah, that's right. And I was just about to mention that. The original negotiating draft text used the word climate refugee. The head of the U.S. delegation, Jonathan Pershing, in the first week of the climate negotiations here in Bonn, made a statement clarifying language that the term climate refugee was not the appropriate term, at least from the U.S. perspective, for various reasons. And that's kind of an official debate. There is a 1951 convention that protects political refugees, and that's linked to commitments and money and countries, you know, committing to protect people who are persecuted for political and other reasons. But besides that word clarification, the text on displacement and migration has remained. It actually expanded a little bit. So for me, you're right, I was optimistic about that. But realistically, in terms of getting things done, it's moving slowly. The money's not on the table yet, and we have a long way to go.
With the comment from Pershing that you mentioned, it sounds almost like in America they're more busy with making sure that no refugees will come to the U.S. rather than helping the poor countries, taking care of, adapting to what will happen.
That's interesting. I don't know the U.S. Delegation's position on migration. I think for most delegates in the climate talks, it's kind of come up recently that they've realized that climate change is going to be a contributing factor to very large flows of people. Going back to the numbers, we didn't in our report take us down in how many people will go or stay, but it's in the tens of millions.
Yeah, but they tend to stay in the same region. So the discussion about climate refugees or climate migrants, it's not really that the issue, I think, because they're not coming to the West. They don't have money to come to the West, so probably mm-hmm. they stay in their own country or region.
Yeah.
But what can the developed countries, what can they do?
Well, what I'm going to tell you is going to sound a little bit general, but I'll tell you a few starting points. The most obvious starting point is we have to really avoid dangerous climate change. We need as strong a possible agreement by industrialized and developing countries in Copenhagen to reduce their emissions. We don't even want to go in this path. We need to avoid dangerous climate change. Beyond and above that, we need to start having some dialogue. Again, not a very sexy thing, but we really need to get governments together to talk about migration and the patterns that we're seeing emerging from this. To go back to a question that you asked, what about the U.S.? Well, we did field work in Mexico, and circular migration is a very common livelihood strategy for many Mexican people going to the United States or to Canada or maybe other places, but it's really north that they go, sending remittances back home and helping their families.
And during your field research, did you find something that surprised you?
Well, something that surprised us was we know that circular migration is a major factor in Mexico and between Mexico and the United States. But something that surprised us was people said, you know, we belong here. We go to the United States temporarily, but our home is here. What surprised us was that people were starting to say, it's starting to be that there's not much to come back to, mm-hmm. and we don't know what we're going to do because we're farmers. We migrate temporarily to work on ranches and farms in the United States, but we really belong here in Mexico. This is our home. And there was just the open question of what do we do if there's no home to come back to? If climate change, as you know, they're kind of major drying trends right now in Mexico linked to climate change. Mm-hmm. And farmers there are just really asking, they don't know what to do. They're a little bit desperate. Mm-hmm. And migration, because it's already an established pattern, there's a lot of question marks there. Will migration become more of a permanent nature towards the United States? I don't have the answers, but a lot of questions now have been raised because of the empirical research that's going on.
Mm-hmm. And in other countries, for example, let's take Vietnam, mm-hmm. there's a project to relocate villages next to the river.
Yeah.
But you weren't too optimistic about these projects.
I think there's a lot to be learned about relocation projects. We looked at maybe 4 or 5 relocation attempts in our 24 case studies. Vietnam was one of them, and the motivation of the program, it's called Living with Floods in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam, is to, one, ensure the physical safety of people, and you can hardly argue with that. But some of the early experiences that are being gathered indicate that it's really tricky to move people. The program moves about 20,000 families 1 to 2 kilometers away from their riverbank homes. And for me, who doesn't face relocation, I think, 1 to 2 kilometers, it's no big deal. That's really not very far at all. And yet, the people who are being moved are vulnerable. Often, they are fisher people or they're day laborers, and they really rely on their connections. They know a person who lives just down the way, maybe just a little bit away. By relocating them, you scramble their social relations, and no one knows them anymore. They're moved into anonymity, and it's hard for them. For example, if I know you and I know that you repair bicycles, I come to you to repair my bike, and that happens, you know, in a community. So there's enough money on the basis of a daily wage to support the family. But if you move to a new city and no one knows you and you don't have social networks, or if you're relocated, at least temporarily, it can represent a loss of social capital.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an area we just need to learn more about. We also need to learn about the successes and what's working. So again, that leads back to this. We need dialogue before this comes a problem of such scale that dialogue becomes politicized and difficult.
And How are you planning to learn about this? I mean, is there any asking the local communities, or is it just academics talking among each other?
Well, there are some kind of small things starting. I couldn't name a massive, huge effort, but for example, some foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation, the German Marshall Foundation, Munich Re Foundation, Robert Bosch Stiftung, and probably many others, those are just a few of the ones that I know of, are sponsoring projects that focus on policy dialogue on the topic of climate change and migration. One that we have just started is going, it's a transatlantic dialogue, so talking between the United States and not just Germany, but countries in Europe, talking about how, you know, what our experiences are with climate change and migration. But one of the unique things is we're also going to our southern neighbors and asking, what are your perspectives? What are your policy? How do you manage migration? And hopefully through these kind of small efforts, we can at least start, as we have with our empirical research, getting the idea of what are the big policy questions? How do you manage that? And then feeding it back into processes like the climate negotiations. Yes,
to go back to Vietnam, there have those people been asked what their solution to the problem might be?
That's a very, very good question.
Instead of just picking them up?
Yeah.
When, I mean,
I can't answer that. I don't know. I know that it's a government program. Mm-hmm. I know that there are recommendations that the people who are affected need to be asked and need to be involved in defining their own positions. The information that we gathered about the Living with Floods program in Vietnam at least recommended that people be involved, but I do not know to the extent that they should be involved. But that's absolutely something that needs to happen in the future if it's not happening now.
Yes, they might prefer to start living on boats. I don't know.
And that's also a question. You know, people might find their own solutions. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the individuals in the affected areas, they have to do the most effort. For example, once they were farmers, but now they are taught to be shrimp farmers or mm-hmm. something else. So they have to do the biggest efforts.
It changes their lives.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's really a very profound change. One thing about the switch from being a rice farmer to a shrimp farmer, rice farming is very labor intensive. And it requires a lot of people to be engaged. So in a way, it's a source of employment. Shrimp farming is rather capital intensive or money intensive and doesn't require as many people to work. And so there are possibilities definitely to shift kinds of employment, but it's a question of whether the same amount of people can be employed.
Yeah. And is there something we as a country, like Belgium, for example, can do on their own?
Well, now that's an excellent question. I believe so. Again, I'll give you a general answer, and more specifics can be filled in. But I think helping foster dialogue between sending and receiving countries, Brussels and, well, rather Belgium is at the heart of Europe, plays a very important role in facilitating dialogue of all sorts of European governments. I think Belgium could be quite important in that way. Mm-hmm. Because we haven't talked so much about it yet, that might be a first step. Another step is to look at assistance programs and whether people can be helped to have options in the places that we live. In every case study that we did, people told us, we don't want to leave. This is our home. We don't want to migrate, at least not permanently. Maybe we'll go out for a little while, but we plan on coming back. So if we collectively could find ways to increase options, livelihood options, risk transfer, risk management options, that would be a big help for local communities that are affected.
And what about consuming less?
Absolutely.
We all have
a collective responsibility. You know, we all need to contribute. This climate change is something, it's really big, and we need governments to cooperate, but we as individual citizens also can contribute a lot.
Have you also investigated the consequences in the West? Because, we feel sad about these poor people in the developing countries, but it's going to be more effective to do something if there are indications that also people in the West will be affected.
That, I think, is a very good point. Our case studies were on purpose selected mostly in developing countries. But maybe I can indicate what other kind of research is going on in industrialized countries. Let me give you an example of, I mean, the obvious ones would be low-lying European countries that could be, you know, facing sea level rise. But we haven't done our research there, so I can't speak very much to coastal areas or to Belgium or the Netherlands. I think I can't speak to that. However, there's some research going on in Alaska. Some indigenous villages up on the coast of Alaska have been facing really rapid erosion rates, so much so that, you know, they'll lose 30 feet of land in an hour because the permafrost is thawing and the ice in that part of the world is receding. And so the people are literally losing their homes from under their feet. Just as an example, we're talking a few dozen villages and not too many people, you know, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 people in a dozen communities. The process has been going on for a decade or more, maybe two decades, and it's cost millions of U.S. dollars to try and figure out how to move the people from where they are to new places. And some interesting dynamics come up. We talked a little bit about this in the Vietnam case, but the people are really concerned about who gets which parcel of land, who gets to be closest to the church and the school and the bar or the pub, you know, these places that have an important social significance of meeting places and all. And I think this is just an early indication of the thinking that we need to do around coastal areas. Similarly, most of the major cities in the world, including in industrialized countries, are on waterways. Mm-hmm. Or
like, for example,
areas.
Belgium and the Netherlands, they're quite low. Some places are below sea level.
That's right.
But the thing is, I think they have much more money to do some research about adaptation. And that's the thing that's lacking in the less developed countries.
Yeah.
So actually, I think your report is more like a cry for help for those countries, because maybe the other countries who are responsible for all the mess, they can help themselves because they have enough money to adapt to the problem.
It could be. I've heard of technological solutions in Belgium and the Netherlands, maybe building dikes or keeping out the sea level rise. There are various things going on that in quite a serious way, but I think your remark is accurate.
How come it costs so much money to look into solutions over there? You talked about how many dollars? You said a study had been
in Alaska.
In Alaska.
Ah, yeah. Oh, it's a lot. You know, you wonder why it takes so much money, but it's really a lot. I can't tell you exactly how much everything costs in Alaska, but maybe I can give you a different example. The United States, as is well known, is closing its kind of camp at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of detainees that need to find a new place to be detained, I guess. And I read in the newspaper yesterday that Palau, out in the South Pacific, has agreed to take 17 people who were in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. And the cost for the United States to relocate those 10 or those 17 people is $200 million. And I'm sure that there are lots of things that are kind of tied into that deal, but these things are not cheap. And so I think we have to find efficient ways and equitable ways to start thinking about how we manage either migration or relocation.
So one wonders about a few thousand years ago when the ice was coming into Europe, people migrated too, and they didn't have any money. How did they do it?
I think that's a very good point. We had different living standards then.
Yes, of course.
You know?
Okay.
Okay, thank you for the explanation.
Yes.
Good luck with presenting reports, and I hope there is going to be a lot of response from lots of countries.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you very much. It's been a wonderful opportunity to talk to you. Thanks.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Zo. Ik heb nog één ding te vermelden in verband met adaptatie in België. Nee, eigenlijk...
van alles.
Omdat we hebben het nog ooit over overstromingen gehad, hier in de Schelde. Toch wel iets dat de mensen zo moeten aanspreken. Ruisbroek, 30 jaar geleden. Hè, dan hebben ze nu eindelijk een dijken en overstromingsgebieden af, waardoor dus maar een overstroming zoals die daar om de 300 jaar is, denk ik, zo voorkomen. Hm? Maar als dus het zeeniveau tegen het eind van de 21ste eeuw zal 60 à 90 centimeter stijgen, en dat zal dus betekenen dus dat risico zal stijgen naar 1 op 25 jaar. Dus dat
Ja, daar heb je
Maar de Scheldekaaien, die worden hier aangelegd en die zijn daarop voorzien. Hè? Die zijn al sowieso hoger gebouwd. Ik denk
ja, maar dat is al